Hi, I'm Steve Byfield. Welcome to the Memoirs of Karate Fighter podcast. I'm here with author Ralph Robb, who wrote Memoirs of a Karate Fighter, and Donald Blaney, who was the original publisher of the book, following a publishing career going back 20 years, as well as being a member of the YMCA team. I've been training for nearly 50 years, starting with judo age 10, and I'm an old boy of the Suzuki Schools of Karate at the Honbu, or Headquarters Dojo, at Manor Place Bars and Marvick House in London. Memoirs of a Karate Fighter is in my top 5 books of all time, and I can recommend it to anyone, whether they practice karate or not. Here's Kimberly Rivando Robb with a synopsis.
Memoirs of a Karate Fighter by Ralph Robb. Swept along by the kung fu craze of the 1970s, as well as the threat of violence from his older cousins and racist thugs, the teenage Ralph Robb joins one of the most successful and toughest karate schools in Britain. Although he grows up in a comfortable and loving home in middle-class area of Wolverhampton, England, Ralph strikes out for independence and moves to a flat in a high-rise tower block where a gang of National Front-supporting skinheads are in residence. In this coming-of-age tale, Ralph tells it how it was for a young black boy as he gradually matures into adulthood in a town where, back in the 1980s, casual racism and violence were all too common. Together with his cousin and best friend Clinton, he trains diligently and is selected to represent Britain at the Under-21 European Karate Championship. But as the jingoism grows to fever pitch in the throes of the Falklands War, Ralph finds himself conflicted. He wants to compete at an international level, but he does not want to wear the emblem of the Union Jack, which has become, for him, a symbol of intolerance. Ralph does win a silver medal, but his aspirations as an international competitor are curtailed when he has to take on work as a nightclub doorman to earn extra money so he can make a deposit for a home for him and his new family. But this is not his only concern. His training partner, Clinton, begins to exhibit behavior that will eventually require him to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act. After extremely rough justice is meted out to a notorious gang of football hooligans by members of the karate club following an unprovoked attack on one of Ralph's younger cousins, and the fights he's witnessed at the doors of the various nightclubs, he begins to question the direction in which his life is heading, as well as his own attitudes to violence. The more he is able to fight, the less inclined he is to do so, and Ralph decides to take another course. One which will lead him to higher qualifications as an engineer and a role in a management at a factory in which he had once served as an apprentice. Following several years as Britain's top team, the karate club begins its slide into decline and members start to fall away. But they do meet up for one last time at the funeral of Clinton following his suicide at the age of 23. The death of his lifelong friend brings about another period of introspection, which will lead Ralph to leave karate and Wolverhampton behind for a new life in Canada with his wife and children.
The second day of the championships progressed quickly, and it did not seem long before I was called to the mat for the semi-final. My prize was now tantalizingly close. 2 more fights and the title of European Under 21 heavyweight champion would be mine. Bird and I were to face 2 Italian fighters, the tall Guazzaroni brothers. Both of them would become top-class competitors, and one would win a world championship 7 years later. My fight would be the first of the 2 semi-finals, and I thought it was a blessing as it gave me less time to be nervous. When the fight got underway, I found that my cagey Italian opponent anticipated my movements extremely well. He had obviously watched me fight and figured out a way to counter my style. His offense, on the other hand, had me baffled. Attacks were launched from unorthodox stances and almost caught me off guard. On several occasions, I just managed to evade his punches and kicks, and the fear of losing a fight entered my head for the first time. It would prove to be a costly lapse in concentration. We continued to shuffle around the mat, and I was thinking about what tactic I should employ next when a lightning-fast Uraken strike with his front hand slammed against the side of my forehead, close to my cup. My eyes smarted as the referee inspected my injury for any further damage before he gestured towards my opponent and awarded him a half point. He was gaining in confidence and looked to quickly capitalize on his advantage with another attack. I did not see it coming, but instinctively I moved my head and the bottom of his heel scraped the side of my face as he attempted to hit me with an axe kick. To add to my indignity, The judge's arm shot up to award a nippon, but he was overruled by the referee after he had halted the bout for a brief consultation. Now I was livid. Screw the tactics, I growled under my breath. I had got this far by fighting to my strengths, but now I was thinking too much about tactics. After all, in Japanese martial arts, the practitioner strives for mushin, no mind, when in a combat situation, so as the body can react without the conscious thoughts that make the actions too ponderous to be effective. In that instant, I decided to revert to the aggressive use of the techniques that had been honed in the YMCA dojo. The referee called for the fight to restart as I thought how I would make my opponent pay for trying to embarrass me. I threw a feint. He reacted. I smiled to myself. Now I had him. Another feint, and he pulled away slightly. The first two punches of my combination only met thin air, but the third landed with a thud. Wazari, called the referee. I had found his weakness, and no sooner had I been awarded the half point when I was back at him. The stinging pain above my eye dictated my next move. Mimicking his technique, I hit the side of his face using Uraken, and immediately followed this up with another powerful reverse punch to his chest. Ippon! I did not allow him to settle after that and continued to force him back until the referee brought the fight to an end with the call of Yame. Well, can you remember much about your first under 21 championship and how did this affect the training at the club leading up to it?
Leading up to the under 21s, it was kind of a complex procedure as such because I'd never prepared for a competition of that level before. Okay, I've seen Hewitt, I've seen Jerome, I've seen Chester River prepare for such a competition, but in my own mind, right, it had to take a more in-depth kind of a training. A lot of that was kind of ad-libbed on my own because I wanted to do something extra. What I mean by ad-libbing, I would try and do stuff on my own at home as well as the stuff from the club. I concentrated a lot, not too much, but a bit on weight training about a month ahead of the competition because I always like to feel I'm physically stronger than my opponent. But weight training, right, can have its negatives as well. But don't forget, right, that you need to remain kind of flexible. You still need to remain flexible. Your reflexes need to be spot on. And in competition at that level, right, it's often down to a matter of a hundredth of a second. And if you tighten up too much with weight training, you're going to eliminate all that. So, as I said, weight training did play a part, but not too big a part. Closer to the competition, I tended to lean off the heavy training as such as the heavy sparring, just for the reasons it would just become too much. You run the risk of being injured. Plus, that's not the type of training I thought you needed right up until the competition. Week before or so, all the sparring would stop and we'd concentrate more on our reflexes and fast reaction, blocking, moving, that type of thing. That's how it generally progressed closer to the competition. I don't know, Don, when you were training with Jerome, how would your training differ building up towards a competition as such?
We were just talking about this not long ago, actually. And the big change came after the 1980 World Championship in Spain. And Jerome was fighting for Britain and they came third. Spain had won the team championship. But Jerome had gone out, I think, first round or second round in the individuals. Very, very disappointed. And, you know, he was always a guy to say, how can I move up a gear? How can I change things? And we changed a few things. But I think you said something absolutely right there. When you talk about levels, European level is so much, it's a little bit better than British or English level. And then world level, again, is a little bit higher than European level. And Jerome had won the EKB championship in 1980, and Chester Morrison, funny enough, had reached the final and had come second to him, so it was good for the YMCA. And I think he'd gone off thinking, yeah, well, I'm English champion now, that the EKB followed the old BKCC championships, and that should get me through it. And it was a kind of rude awakening, really. So when we came back...
The biggest difference I found was that there was no room for relaxing. As soon as you relax, right, you can't. At a smaller competition, regional competition, you know full well that the level is not that high, so you could relax a little bit, you could experiment a little bit. But at that level, you can't. You got to be on your game right at the beginning.
When you were competing in the under 21 championships. This was EKB, yes?
The Europeans you're talking about.
You're talking about the European championships.
Well, what was the first under 21 competition that you fought in? Were you a member of the UKKW at that time?
The UKKW did run an under 21. And I think you fought Jeff Thompson, actually, many, many years ago.
Are you? I didn't even know. I wasn't even aware that the UKKW had an under 21.
They had a couple, actually. And they had one in Burnley, and the other one was in Coventry.
Okay, I've never been to Burnley, but been to Coventry a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah. And you were about 16 or 17, and it was decided to throw you in. And you fought Jeff in the final. And you were a young guy. I mean, Jeff is my age, so he had 4 or 5 years over you. And he might have only been 16, Ralph, to be honest. So,
when you say the under 21, are you talking about the EKB under 21s or the UKKW?
No, they did. The EKB, Ralph missed out on that. We had another fighter called Errol Flash. He got to the final of the under 21s at the EKBs. I don't know what happened to Ralph that year, actually. And I think Leslie did quite well.
Yeah, because I was never in there.
And UKKW won the team. Jerome won the individual. Chester Morrison was second. Frank Brennan and all those guys were competing. I think the KUGB came third. The SKU came second. But I think we used to put Ralph in at a very early age. I mean, at 16 or 17, he was fighting, you know, guys a lot more experienced than he was. But the European under-21s, he fought in Scotland at under-21 level.
The Scottish thing, right, was more of a trial to see who was going to go through to
But it was an international match. It was at under-21s. It wasn't full. It was at under-21 level.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's got you selected for the Europeans.
I'm just talking about the Europeans. I'm not talking about the Scottish thing, which we've covered already.
Okay.
Or the UKKW, which I can't even remember. Right. But the EKB, which I was
Everybody can't even remember getting to the final. I remember it well. It was April 1978. How old were you in 78?
78, 17, 16.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see. So
that's young.
Was young. But you see, he was a young talent, you see. And like I say, he got to the final. So I have that down in my little notebook, actually, the results. So I know that to be true. I can actually give you the exact date. I think it was in April.
And it's a pity that we entered so many competitions, right, that they all tend to blur into one after a while.
Yeah.
I think what you did say to me when we were writing the book, that the semi-final stuck in your mind because the axe kick you nearly dropped on your head.
I just about to vague it, right? And the bottom of the guy's feet was dirty. And he left a mark all the way down my face and all the way down my gi. If that would have hit me, right, I'd still be feeling the effect today.
You'd probably be
I wanted to kill him after that, I tell you.
I had been sitting morosely with a towel over my head, replaying the only fights I had lost in 2 days of competition, when an official with the British squad told me to put on my tracksuit for the medal ceremony. Without uncovering my head, I told him that I did not have a tracksuit. "Ralph, it's part of the dress code," he said, by way of explaining why he was still standing over me. "I never got a tracksuit," I said. "And you never got a badge to sew on your gi either?" He was referring to the small embroidered representation of the Union Jack that I had thrown into the bin, as I had done with the England badge before the match with Scotland. My reluctance to display a national allegiance had obviously been noted. "It's on my other gi," I replied. "I bought this one by mistake." "Don't worry about the tracksuit. A lot of fighters from other countries don't have one." "It's our code," he insisted. "No tracksuit, no medal." "That's okay with me," I said. From under the edge of my towel, I saw him flounce away in his grey flannels and navy jacket, which had a badge on its breast pocket that proudly proclaimed his allegiance to Britain, or at least to her karate team. I imagined that whoever he was talking to would put my truculence down to the bitter disappointment of losing the final, but the shrewder amongst them would read something else into my motives. I saw the flannels and a tracksuit approach. I lifted the towel to see the team coach with a tracksuit top in his hand. "Use this one for the ceremony, eh, Ralph?" he said as he thrust it towards me. I gazed at its little embroidered flag, and there was a moment in which I paused and thought about handing back the tracksuit. It was the same emblem I had seen on the car that had carried around the men from the National Front. It was the flag that appeared on the literature that I pushed through my door. It had become a symbol of hate, and the sight of it turned my stomach. In the book, you mentioned your reluctance to wear the tracksuit uniform that had the England karate badge on it. Can you give a little more background to that?
You have to take it into consideration in the context of the time, right, in which we're living. Growing up as a kid, very often you'd be run down by grown men who just wanted to abuse you or racially abuse you just because you're different than them. Now, as you grew older, right, you tend to realize, right, that the same attitude by these people who was running me down as a kid was being portrayed by the National Front, who was marching on a regular basis through Wolverhampton. Now, when these guys marched, they always had the Union Jack with them, and they used to proudly march behind it. Now, for me to wear that England badge at that particular time would be giving credence to all these guys who wanted me out of the country, okay, because of the color of my skin. And there's no way I was going to wear the badge at that particular time because of my own personal feelings of what was going on at the time. That's not to say I was against anybody wearing the badge. If you wanted to wear the badge, feel free. It's up to you. That was just my own particular feeling at that time.
Well, I can understand on many levels.
There'd been a big National Front march in 1981 in Wolverhampton. I mean, a really big march. And I wasn't in Wolverhampton at the time. I was in Ireland. Been in Ireland for a while, about a year, and I came back, and there was this indefinable something about Wolverhampton that had changed. There are a lot more people on the defensive about things, and I didn't know what had happened previously, but of course then it suddenly the penny dropped about what was going on, because you would see a few more slogans on the wall, the old NF up there and things like that, and so there was a little bit more of a hostile environment, definitely, than I previously remembered. Or maybe when you're used to something, you get submerged in it and you just take it as the norm. But when you go out of that circumstance for a year or two, or just for any period, and you come back, it's a bit like seeing a child. A child suddenly seems to have grown. Well, you know, the antipathy, and there's a certain amount of racist feelings that far more evident in Wolverhampton, say, by 1982. And I think Rob touches on that in the book.
You know, well, I think there still is. I think it still exists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
As I said earlier, there's nothing wrong, right, with feeling pride in your country in which you grew up, which you belong to, right? But when that pride starts to spill over into xenophobia and nationalism, that's where it doesn't become good. And don't forget, right, around that particular time, right, you had the Falklands War as well. So all these attitudes, right, it was coming out. One of the reasons why I didn't want to wear it.
The thing about Ralph was at the time, and I'm talking about the ideas of the seniors who were watching him train, that he was going to use the under-21s as a launch pad into an international career that would probably get him at least a European championship. I know Jerome felt that way because he'd been down that path. And he'd actually won more fights at the European under-21s and any other British competitor. And there were quite a few good names that went on to win medals at international level in that side.
Yeah.
And then in his first senior tournament, he came second in the English Championships. And then he got a bronze medal the following year in the EKC Championships. So it looks as though he had a great base to work off. And we certainly expected him to do at least what Leslie Fairclough did at the club, who became a European champion.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm kind of flattered by it all, but my head wasn't all there at the time. But after the Europeans and when the club decided to slide, okay, my head wasn't there. Other things in life started to crop up, and you tend to think to yourself, is karate my life, or is there a life outside karate? Was karate just a sport in which you try to do your best in, but there are more important things outside life than just karate as such, which my father used to tell me all the time, because he was having anything to do with karate. Dead against it. He used to call it foolishness.
And you have to invest a lot of your time and energy into it.
It ain't just investing, it's the fact that you invest in your time to compete at that level as well, right? As somebody once told me, right, you have to be extremely selfish.
Oh, yes.
If very selfish, and you're going to put people who should matter to you You have to push them to the sidelines, which again, I started to question as I started to wonder whether or not this is the path for me.
Yeah. Okay. I think the irony of that was that in 1982, which was the year we're talking about, was probably the YMCA's peak year, although nobody knew it at the time. And we were part of what was called the UKKW, which was the big Wadjuru organization in Britain. And we just won that team championship. But we'd also had the first four places in the individual. And we'd also won the junior team championship. Things had moved on, and we were thinking about leaving UKKW, which we eventually we did, because it wasn't actually providing much for us at the time as we saw it. But we'd had Danny Moore win the European Wadaroo Championships and Gerald Mackinson win the senior European All-Stars Heavyweight Championship in Sweden. And so we were on a bit of a crest, and then he went on to represent Britain in the World Championships in Taiwan, along with Jeff Thompson, etc. And they won that championship, and he came third in the individuals open weight, which he thought was a disappointment. He expected to win that time, but Jeff Thompson had won the individual heavyweight championship, and Pat McKay had won the light heavy. At that time, it was the one overarching world organization. You could say it was a world championship event because it had people from the five continents competing. But just getting back to Ralph, first off, he got struck down with two really horrendous injuries that did kind of halt his training for a while. I remember when he lost the semi-final in the English Championship to a guy who he barely touched, who did a great job of pretending he was almost dead. And I noticed the change in attitude in Ralph from that day. He was never that committed to competition after that.
Perhaps winning is not always a good thing, as it can change people, and not for the better. Britain had triumphed over Argentina for the Falklands Malvinas and had bought flags hanging out of many windows in the tower block in which I lived and on lampposts which lined my normal route to work. The gang of skinheads held noisy celebrations somewhere in the flats above me as though they themselves had won the war. I was keeping an eye on them without saying anything about it to Hilda, as I had put them on the top of my list of suspects as regards for the culprits who had stolen and then burnt my car. In truth, part of me wanted them to be guilty so I could vent my anger on them. I had watched them from a distance strut around the place with a swagger I had not seen before. There were reports of them beating up a couple of lads during their revelry because they looked like Argies. More likely, they were a pair of unfortunate Asian men. When I heard that, I gave up trying to understand just what was behind their hatred of people they did not even know. It was as I was packing my gi that it occurred to me that they had been caught up in an atmosphere that must have been similar to that which pervaded Japan in the 1930s. Was it that Hironori Otsuka and the other martial artists who had joined the Black Dragon Society and who had been revered by so many generations of their followers were little different in their outlook from the bigoted gang of skinheads who lived above me? It was a sobering thought, and one I chose not to dwell upon. The events during and in the immediate aftermath of the Short War had only served to alienate me even further from many of the people who I lived amongst. When the Argentinian battleship, the Belgrano, was sunk with the cost of hundreds of lives, a sizable proportion of my workmates celebrated the news as if they had learned of a football result. A plethora of Union Jack flags hung from the girders in the factory and made me wish that my life was as it had been only months before and that Hilda was not expecting our baby. That way, I would have resigned or got myself fired. It may have seemed strange that as a person who studied an art that was born out of warlike impulses, I was opposed to the war, but in my 20-year-old head, the matter was a simple one. People whom I did not like also happened to be people who were all too readily caught up in the jingoism and xenophobia, while the people for whom I had most regard, if not so open as I was in their opposition, were at least quietly questioning the morality of the war. The people who offended me the most were the likes of Fat Bert, who I had down as a member of the National Front, who came to work with a plastic bowler hat which was painted red, white and blue, and the small band of men who had tattoos of bulldogs etched onto their arms with Falklands 82 underneath. Thankfully, my mate Mick was not getting involved in the fevered nationalism. He had enough sense of achievement derived from his Shotokan not to bask in the reflected glory of a victory many thousands of miles away. That is, if there was any glory or victory in what I perceived as an unjustified waste of human life.
Visit our website at www.ralphrobb.com. Do you have questions or comments? Email us at ralph@ralphrobb.com. I'm Kimberly Rivando-Robb, and I am signing up.